You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, kujastamong tokingoa, noi mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā, te rā rua te kaumātahi o Kohitātea. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Tuesday, the 21st of January. My name is Justin and I will be with you for the next hour. Next to me is Louis Laws, who was the brightest of the Monday Wire, of which I've successfully pinched. How are you today?
Oh, I wouldn't know quite if I'm the brightest of the Monday Wire, but I'm good today, Justin. How are you?
I am very well. Excited for anything happening next week?
Oh, well, it is Auckland Anniversary Day, and you know that means it's Laneway.
It's Laneway.
So that should be pretty fun.
It will be fun.
Yeah.
And speaking of fun, FIKA coming up on our show today. Lots of fun stuff. First up, what have you got, Louis?
Yes, I'll be talking to Hugh Palovich about the increasing of unaffordability of the housing market.
Afterwards, I talked to Professors Graham Gill and William Partlett about proposed constitutional changes in Russia and the fallout from the resignation of the Russian government. Afterwards, Chris McGarrell talked to Kerry Davis from the PSA about home support workers. And finally, I talked to Professor Susie Wiles of Auckland University about the recent pneumonia outbreak in China. As always, he aha ofakara, get in touch with us with any thoughts you have. I love hearing from you. Tuku patuhi mai, you can text us on 5395. Why mai, call us in studio 309-379. Me koa e wareware e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene korero ano hei pakihere rokiroki maurunga I te paitukutuku o irirangi poho. Me haere ki 95BFM airakati.com. And don't forget, you can catch all these stories in full and more by a podcast on our website 95BFM.com. I tēnei wā tonu, coming right up.
The Wire. Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
Yesterday, the 16th annual Demographia International Housing Affordability Survey was released. This ranks 8 countries' housing markets worldwide, and it was found that New Zealand's housing was severely unaffordable. It seems red tape, lice, land price inflation, rock-bottom interest rates, and lots of speculation are fueling New Zealand's runaway property market. And it's news, it's no news, and it seems to be getting worse, now it's the nurses, the teachers, and other middle-class professionals who are increasingly unable to buy houses in the cities where they work, with prices now 7 times the median household income. So I spoke with you, Hugh Pavlich, co-author of the Demographia International Housing Affordability Survey, to discuss the findings, as well as hear some of his recommendations.
This covers some 309 markets throughout the world, throughout the mainly the English-speaking world, some 8 countries, and we rate them every year. The cities within those countries, the metros of those cities, those metros at least, on housing affordability. So, what actually came out of this year's one is that it has actually worsened in New Zealand. We've gone up from about 6.5 times household incomes to 7 across our 8 metros, which is extremely serious, and we're now sitting at roughly about we're the worst in the English-speaking world, and we're the only one ahead of us is Hong Kong, as far on the which is sitting about a 20 multiple, but we shouldn't be anywhere near that. We're actually just double, if you like, the United States at 3.5 times incomes.
Right, yeah. You know, the survey, it also looked into this affordability from other parts of the world. So how does New Zealand fare against these countries? Was it 8 countries, you said?
That is correct, 8 in total. And also we did a supplementary with Russia as well this year, which is just most interesting as well. The people there back in the Institute for Urban Economics in Moscow did a tremendous job, and we added that in as a supplement, just so people can get a sort of a bit of an introduction, if you like, to what's going on in Russia.
So
that's all in there as well. And the introduction focused very much on Singapore, which has been a huge success, of course, in a very short span of 60 years, where people were living in slums some 60 years ago, but now it's rated as one of the most wealthy countries in the world. You know, it's been a remarkable success story, Singapore, and in the housing as well.
Yes.
So, but just going through the eight countries that we surveyed, but for example, across the board, Australia now is about 6, roughly 5.9 to 6.
Right.
Canada is sitting at about 3.9. And then we've got China, Hong Kong, which is sitting way up the top at 20. It's right out of control. And then below that we have Ireland, which is sitting about 4.1. New Zealand at a terrible 7 times incomes. And below, and Singapore is sitting at 4.6, which is remarkable for such a small country. And the United Kingdom is sitting at 4.5. And Canada and the United States are sitting at 3.6.
Right. Yeah.
New Zealand basically at 7 is virtually double the US.
It's a bit ridiculous, you know. I mean, it's crazy for such a small country as well to have such an unaffordability of its housing. I guess
it's actually hugely embarrassing because we're roughly about the same size as the United Kingdom in land area. Okay, and they have a population of about 65 million. And we have a population here who whisker under 5 million, and just 0.7% of New Zealand is urbanised, and we have all this land available just to expand, and we're in this sort of ridiculous position. It's in the absurd category, frankly.
I guess what I want to ask now is, you've made a few comments about the report and also what you believe are some of the most contributing factors. And one of these is the inflating land prices. What leads to inflating land prices?
The primary reason, how did this all really came about? There's quite a historical thing to it. The worst thing that happened in this country was in the late 80s, when we had the forced amalgamation of the councils. And there are two types of councils in this world, the small and the bad, in my view, and we see that down here in Christchurch.
Yeah.
With respect to the bureaucratically bloated Christchurch City Council, which is ungovernable and unmanageable, and everybody knows it. And the good performers, such as Selwyn to the south of Christchurch and Waimakariri to the north, and they're driving, if you like, the whole housing affordability here in Christchurch. And if we didn't have those two smaller councils with the earthquakes, we would have driven housing up to 10 times incomes here in Christchurch.
Wow.
But instead they're sitting now at 5.4, and they've been declining quietly for the last lot of years because of the amount of supply that we can get in across this greater Christchurch area. And so it's staring them right in the face about what the problems and the solutions are. But I'm very pleased to say that what we have now is three key political initiatives that are underway. And the first one is, came out late October, was the Urban Development National Policy Statement, which is to do with tidying things up and getting some disciplines into the RMA. That's all to the good. And then in December, which wasn't particularly well reported, the two key pieces of legislation which were introduced into the Parliament, the first one was the Urban Development Bill for the first reading, and secondly, the Infrastructure Funding and Financing Bill. And the speech in there by, in my view, by Phil Twyford, the Minister for Urban Development, was simply outstanding. And he made the point of making it very clear in that speech that he has the support of the parties right across the political spectrum, the major parties at least, and that's National, Labour, New Zealand First, and the Greens, all support that legislation, and they're all working to get this debt financing of infrastructure sorted out. I commend Phil Twyford for that, and also those who are in there helping to do this. So what we need to ensure that does happen going forward is that the legislation is tidied up, the infrastructure financing is tidied up, so that we do learn from the United States, which has had 100 years experience of this, and they have the municipal bond market over there, which is something like a $3.7 trillion market, and municipal utility districts, and we want to be learning from their experiences and bringing something here that mirrors that and is adapted to our local conditions.
You've said a lot there, and I just really want to kind of, you know, maybe even downpack that if we can. But on a more positive note, you said with the legislation that has been going through, the Urban Development National Policy, which was passed in October.
Two key pieces of legislation.
Yes, yes.
That were introduced into the House, and they're covered within the survey this year, mm-hmm. and also up on my website. And a very key question that we want to be asking ourselves, Louis, is... Mm. And it's on the front of my 209. It was also in the United States section 2 of the survey, and up on my archival website in the 219 2019 section is the National Association of Home Builders reports on the prices of lots in the state, lots or sections in the state, and the price has now moved up to $49,500 for the median price for a lot in America now.
Right.
And they're screaming blue murder, if you like. And 4 out of 5 Americans are of the view that they have a housing affordability crisis.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they're housing at 3.5 times incomes across the board. So, with ours at 7, really, we should be having just about riots in the streets, shouldn't we?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, there's this. You see now an emerging class of citizens who, you know, a middle class, and they're working, and they're making, you know, well over the median wage, but they can't afford a house, and that's just ridiculous, really.
The whole thing is an obscenity, and it's also too a serious breach of basic human rights.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people have the right, or should have the right, to accessing. Affordable housing, and by denying that is actually, you know, those people who are responsible for that, it should be treated in that light, that these people need to have it pointed out to them.
Yeah,
they're actually
yeah.
breaching basic human rights.
You're absolutely hitting the nail right on the head with that one. Hugh, as the co-author of the Demographia, what further recommendations would you make in the long term for this in New Zealand?
Well, what we should be doing is asking the very basic question, when can we expect to see sections or lots out in the fringes of our cities at or below $50,000? And that's just cutting right to the chase. Get through all the rubbish and all the technical stuff. Leave that to others to sort of sort out. But ask that very basic question, which is what they have in America, for example, and we should also have here. So, and that's all about, if you like, buying land at rural values, not paying artificial planning values for the stuff. And secondly, properly debt financing infrastructure, and we can easily achieve that. So. If you get those, focus on those two things, the land supply and the debt financing of infrastructure, the rest will all pretty much look after itself.
This is a sad, sad day. BFM, the font of liberalism and tolerance at the centre of the University of Auckland.
The Wire.
That was Louis talking to Hugh Pavlich, who is the co-author of the Demographia International Housing Affordability Survey, of which they discussed the findings of it, as well as hearing his recommendations. Ko te waia tene marunga irirangi poho. We will be back after this. This is Raw Power by Iggy and the Stooges.
Let's pull that out of here. Wow, what a perfect day for a cool, refreshing Kiwi craft beer. You want something?
Just one of whatever you're getting.
Well, there's heaps to choose from.
I'm easy.
You're easy?
Yeah, I'm easy.
Let's take it slow. Here, we can try it before we buy. Easy, no worries.
I'm not worried.
Get yourself a craft beer education this summer at 16 Tonne, where craft beer is as easy as 3, 2, 1. 16 Tonne, Jellicoe Street, Wynyard Quarter. Go to 16tonne.co.nz or check them out on Instagram and Untapped.
In the market for a cleaner, healthier home? Craft Homes is your first choice. They work with you from design to project completion for a home that's minimum impact, maximum efficiency. Building Homestar 6 homes through to Passive House standard, Craft Homes are smarter, more energy efficient, and built from sustainable and environmentally friendly products. Don't just build a home, build a more sustainable future. Craft Homes. Homestar approved practitioners. Go to crafthomes.co.nz.
Glenn, what are you doing? You've been in there since 1 o'clock.
Mum, get out.
What are you... Oh my God, Glenn, you're completely soaked in gin.
Mum, it's just music.
God, you're dripping eclectic tunes and handpicked vinyl everywhere.
God.
Do you even know what genres you've been trying?
Mum, it's genre free.
Sweet Jesus, come on, into the shower. You're sweating music everywhere.
The Tuesday 1 to 4 show with Jen. 3 hours of genre-free musical exploration for your Tuesday afternoon. Right here on 95BFM. Sit back, open your ears, and let it all soak in.
Today, we do not know what they want. They do not know themselves what they really want.
I've been wondering what that special place in hell looks like for those who promoted Brexit without even a sketch of a plan how to carry it.
Brexit means Brexit.
To Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire, and now we are going to Moscow. Major political change is happening in Russia right now as President Vladimir Putin announced major constitutional changes in his annual address. The amendments Putin put forward include term limits for the president, more authority for parliament, which will be able to choose the prime minister, and wider powers for the state council. I spoke with Professor Graham Gill of the University of Sydney to find out what these changes mean to Russian politics and why Putin decided to change the constitution.
Well, according to the current constitution, the president is directly elected by the people, and he then nominates a prime minister who is approved by the state Duma. So the president actually chooses the prime minister, and the Duma approves of it. Under Yeltsin, that was a problem for the president, but under Putin, that's not been a problem. What he's proposing instead is that instead of the president choosing the prime minister will instead be chosen by the state Duma and then approved by the president, with the president not having the power to refuse to approve it. So what it means is that instead of the prime minister and the government being responsible to the president, they will then be responsible to the state Duma. So it introduces a system rather more like New Zealand's and Australia's, that is a parliamentary style system, although it would be a president, rather than a presidential system like in the US.
And now after these changes, it will be a reduced presidency. So what powers will the Kremlin still have?
Well, it's not immediately clear how it's all going to work itself out, because we haven't seen the precise details of what he's suggesting. But the point is that it will mean that the president is less directly involved in policy making and responsible for policy making than he is at the moment. At the moment, formally, the president is responsible for foreign affairs, and the Prime Minister for domestic affairs, but actually, of course, the President has final say in both spheres. If this goes ahead, the likelihood is that the President will not have as much a sway or as much a say in either international politics or in domestic politics. That power and that authority should shift to the Prime Minister.
Another aspect that Putin's constitutional changes involved is the Russian State Council. So what is the State Council, the constitution today?
The State Council is a purely advisory body that was set up by Putin. This would embed it in the constitution, and it would presumably give it some sort of a general oversight role. And the suggestion is that Putin might step down from being president, either when his term concludes in 2024 or earlier, if he decides to step down and move into the position as head of the State Council, and that would give him sort of general oversight of what happens without having direct control of the leaders of policy.
But in general, why does Putin decide to make these constitutional changes? Is it just to make sure he still has power after 2024?
Well, it may be that. The point is, of course, Putin is almost 70. That's not very old, but when the expected life of a Russian male is in the low 70s, he is getting on within a Russian context, and it's quite clear that he's grown somewhat tired of the being involved in the detail of policy formulation. And so I think what he wants to do is to step back, give himself a continuing position potentially through this leadership of the State Council, but not have to get involved in all of the nitty-gritty of policy development and policy analysis. So that if this comes off and he does choose to play that role, and we don't know that yet, but it would mean that what he would have will be a general oversight view, something like Lee Kuan Yew had in the last years of his life in Singapore, for example.
And are those constitutional changes quite supported in Russia?
Well, it's not clear at the moment because they came as a shock to everybody, so there's been no opinion polling data which would really tell us one way or the other what people think. And as I said, I mean, the details still remain to be seen. He said that the changes should be put before the people so that there will be a popular vote on them. That, I guess, would tell us whether they're popular or not, although the likelihood is that if Putin supports them, the majority of people will support them as well.
Currently, Dan, now, there's still 4 more years until Putin needs to step down. Why does he suddenly decide to announce these changes?
One reason might be that if he let things go on as they were, he would effectively become a lame duck president, in the sense that people know that he can't be president again unless something unusual happens, if he changes the constitution to make that possible or something like that. And once you are a lame duck president, it means that people give you less, accord you less authority. Increasingly, people begin to mobilise at the top of the political system for the succession because they know that the succession is coming and that they really don't have much to fear from the president because he is in this lame duck situation. So by, in a sense, clarifying what the situation is going to be like once he ceases to be president, he does away with that lame duck status. And that thereby, in a sense, continues to enable him to project his power into the future.
If Putin wants to hold state power in Russia, why can't he just did what he did in 2008 when he swapped the presidency for a prime ministership with Dmitry Medvedev?
Because I think he's sick of the policy detail that is involved in that job, because that job clearly does involve direct participation in the working out of policy in all of its details. And I think Putin, given his age, he wants to step back from that. But he doesn't want to completely give up power. So he's potentially establishing this general oversight position, which would enable him to retain a degree of power without being bogged down in policy papers and the policy detail.
Following Putin's announcement, Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev and the whole cabinet resigned and he was replaced by Mikhail Mishustin. This decision took a lot of people by surprise because Medvedev was a close ally of Putin. And as mentioned earlier, when Putin's first stint as president ended in 2008, he was forced to vacate the office as, according to the current constitution, Medvedev replaced him as president while Putin served as prime minister until 2012. Now, what does that mean for Medvedev and who exactly is Mishustin? I discussed these questions with Associate Professor William Partlett of the University of Melbourne.
My expectation is he was asked to resign. because what's happening now is there's a transition of power going on, a slow transition of power, and Putin has asked Medvedev to make way so that they can find a successor and they can move to in 2024 a new president.
And Medvedev is now serving as the vice president of the Security Council. So what exactly is the Security Council?
It's an institution that it works under the office of the president that makes decisions with regards to security decisions and so forth, coordinates the security policy of the Russian Federation. So it's a position with some power, but not as powerful as the head of the prime minister.
So it is safe to say that Medvedev has been demoted.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right. And now by his demotion, does it mean he has been thrown aside by Putin himself, or can we expect to see him back at the full light of politics in Moscow?
That's a good question. Predicting Russian politics is a very dangerous thing. It's hard to tell at this point what is going to happen with Medvedev. I will say, though, the bigger story here is the constitutional changes that are being made, the actual fundamental changes to the Russian structure of government. I think there is the political short-term movement of individuals like Medvedev and others is one thing, right, which is a kind of short-term political move. But the broader story here, if you're looking for a story to write about what's significant about this long term, is the changes that Putin has proposed and that have now been introduced to the Duma, Russian Parliament, to change the constitutional structure, and as many people have suggested, including myself, to actually protect Putin when he steps down from the presidency in 2024. So the kind of structural constitutional changes, I think, is the big story coming out of this. The personnel changes are hard to tell what's going to happen, other than that there currently is a significant kind of shift going on in the way that the government's going to work going forward.
And let's talk about his successor, Mikhail Mishustin. So a lot of us outside who doesn't have really a focus on Russia don't really know who that is. So who exactly is Mishustin?
Well, I mean, a lot of people who study Russia, like I do, had no idea who he is. I mean, he's the head of the tax. He's an obscure individual who was the head of the tax ministry who no one really had any idea who he was. He's never been mentioned as anyone who would ever replace Putin or even be prime minister. So he's been put there because he's loyal. He's been put there because he has absolutely no political or public profile. So he's completely controllable. He is a technocrat who will do as Putin says. So that's who, as far as I can tell, who he is. He didn't even have a English language Wikipedia page until he was appointed. So this caught everyone off guard, including people who study the region. So, it's fair to say that it was a surprising choice, but one that is likely he's there for, I think most people think he's likely going to be there for a little while, but he's not going to be a particularly big player in Russian politics going forward.
Mm-hmm. But in retrospect of all of this, is this significant in Russian history? What, even maybe even stretch it back to the Soviet Union?
Oh, it's significant, again, from what I was saying before, more from the fact that there are at least proposed changes to how the actual government is structured, and in particular, there might be, we'll see, we're still waiting to see what the precise details are, but a fundamental or a shifting of power in how Russia is governed. At the moment, it is a highly presidential system where the president dominates all forms of Russian politics, and at least seems possible that with these changes that are now being proposed by Putin, and if he steps down from the presidency, that the presidency will be less dominant And that's significant from a historical point of view, I think. But again, we have to wait and see what the final changes are to the constitutional structure. Potentially, the long term could be that as a way to ensure himself, right? Because, you know, obviously, if Putin steps down from the presidency, he doesn't want a really, really strong next president to imprison him or put him on trial or something like that. He has to weaken the presidency. Mm-hmm. That in and of itself is significant, right? It means that to give himself political insurance, he actually has to change the structure of the government somewhat. And that is a big shift. Potentially could be a big shift. So I think that's kind of what I think a lot of people are thinking is significant about what's happening now.
That was me talking to Professors Graham Gill and William Partlett about the current situation in Russia.
The Wire.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
Home support workers have been providing and caring for those in need in New Zealand. However, they have been working in poverty for decades, struggling to make ends meet. 2 years ago, after a historic equal pay settlement, which ended long-term pay discrimination against these workers, many complain they are still facing a new struggle against shortened hours, irregular job security, and inadequate resources. The Public Service Association represents home support workers who are employed by various private companies and not-for-profits on behalf of DHBs, ACC and the Ministry of Health. Chris McGaddle spoke to Kerry Davis from the Public Service Association about this, and he first asked what difficulties are home workers facing.
The home support services enable people to live in their own homes independently without having to be admitted to hospital or into, if you're older, into a rest home. So what home support services do is a professional home support worker will visit individual clients' homes and give them assistance, support, both for personal cares such as showering and any other help in terms of intimate care. In addition, assistance around the house in terms of with housework that they're unable to do, either because of a disability or an injury. So, yeah, so they're vital services that enable people to continue to participate in their local communities without having to be move out of their homes into a rest home situation. Some of the difficulties that people, home support workers, will struggle with is having sufficient time to be able to provide the level of support and assistance that clients receive. Increasingly, pressure is being put on support workers to do provide the same level of support, or indeed increasing levels of support, within reduced time periods, and also with multiple clients being banked up in terms of double bookings. So there really is a pressure on people to be able to do the work as well and as properly as they really need to be able to do it.
So how would you say things have progressed, or indeed not progressed, since the equal pay settlement that was concluded 2 years ago?
Well, the good thing is that people have got an increase in their hourly pay rate, which properly recognises their skills. But because, in our view, there hasn't been sufficient funding to properly implement the equal pay increases, along with guaranteed hours and travel time and payment for petrol reimbursement, this means that providers are increasingly cutting back on the time that's allocated to provide support. So people are having their hours cut. And so we have cases where people have actually had a reduction in their take-home pay because their hourly rate's gone up, but their number of hours has gone down.
Large percentage of home support workers are women. Do you think that any of the, I guess, lack of pay or kind of adverse conditions that home support workers have been facing is due to any gendered aspect, some kind of sexism on the part of employers or anything of the sort?
Well, the whole issue of the undervaluation of the work in the first place was very much about the discrimination against jobs that are predominantly done by women, where the skills associated with them have not been traditionally valued. And when we've done proper job assessments, we find that the level of the skill, responsibility and knowledge required to do the job should be getting paid at a higher rate of pay. And so we've managed to get that in terms of the hourly rate, get a recognition of the increase in the pay rates to better reflect the value of the work. But without commensurate increases in funding and a properly nationally funded and consistent funding model across the whole sector, then that enables providers to cut back support hours when to ensure that they have sufficient funds to be able to pay people.
So what do you think should be done to fix the situation, either on the part of public health authorities or of the contracting employers themselves?
I think it's beholden on the Ministry of Health and the DHBs to take, as the funders, to take some leadership in this area and implement the recommendations from the review that was done way back in 2015 into the home and community sector. There was a report that was given to the Director General of Health that, in 2015 that made some really important recommendations, and they included increasing the level of funding and changing the funding model to better put the sector on an equal footing with other areas within the health sector, so that could enable people to genuinely get guaranteed hours of work, so that when there's an increase in pay, you don't get a commensurate decrease in your hours of work to compensate for it.
Do you have a message for the public, for the reason, tell people why they should be concerned about this issue and what they could do to support struggling workers?
Well, it's something that all of us should have a really strong opinion about. If we're lucky enough to get to an older age where we require home support services, then we really would value them, and we don't. That's likely to increase the need for these home support services. It's likely to increase as we have an ageing population. Also, if you've had an injury, you have an accident, and you're needing support to shower or to help around the house, then home support services are really vitally important for you to be able to do that. And what it does is it facilitates recovery a lot more quickly, particularly when you've had an injury. So it's something that is an integral part of our health system that needs to be properly funded and properly appreciated and valued.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Ki te whakarongo koe, ki te waia marunga Irirangi Pōho. That was Chris talking to Kerry Davis from the PSA about the working conditions of home support workers. We are having a break now, and here's Sur la Planche by La Femme. You're on BFM with Justin.
doctor, I've been feeling very hot all the time.
Go on.
I'm also incredibly anxious about how I look.
Well, this is very straightforward. I prescribe a Swish News summer wardrobe post-haste.
Not therapy?
Retail therapy.
Refresh your wardrobe this summer at Teddy's Designer Recycle. Take your unwanted summer clothes in now and refill your clothes rack with some breezy new threads. Teddy's Designer Recycle, 161 Ponsonby Road and 47 High Street.
Are you a real doctor?
Hakarongo mai, it's Māori words, because he waka eke noa. Kia ora e te tau. Hey babe.
Kia ora e te tau. How are you?
What are you after?
I was wondering if we could not watch Doctor Who tonight.
Kia ora e te tau. Hey babe. Māori words, karawhiua, give it a go.
You look different.
Cheers, yeah, I got a new haircut.
No, it's not that. You're like way hotter.
Okay.
And I respect you more. Also, you look smarter and better at sports.
I mean, I got a B card.
That's it! Yup, the B card.
The B card.
The B card.
It's how you win sick prizes. It's how you get incredible discounts. And it's how you help us stay on a platform for awesome, out there music, hard hitting news, and the odd bit of cheeky nonsense. Sign up for a B card for just $4.20 a month and support independent media. Go to 95bfm.com/sign up.
The French, for instance, love the cock.
You're tuned into The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire, and finally for today, we are going to a story, developing story in China. Over 200 people, including 15 medical personnel, have been infected by a new strand of coronavirus, killing four. It began in the Chinese city of Wuhan, with most of these infected visited a seafood market, which also sold live animals. Despite authorities had initially maintained that there were no evidence that this virus was contagious between humans, a senior mainland health official has now confirmed that this virus is spreading via person-to-person transmission. Currently, outside of Wuhan, cases have been reported in Beijing, Japan, Thailand, and just yesterday in South Korea. This new virus also belongs to the same family as other severe diseases, such as SARS in 2003, which killed 700 people, and recently MERS in the 2010s. To find out more about coronaviruses, I spoke to Susie Wiles of Auckland University.
So there are a large family of viruses that are found in humans and animals. The human versions tend to cause things like common cold, but there have been a couple of instances in the past where a coronavirus has moved from an animal to a human and caused a large outbreak of nasty pneumonia. So SARS is one example of that, and then another one is MERS. So SARS came from a civet cat to humans, and MERS came from, comes from camels.
When you mention MERS and SARS, from the information that is available now, can scientists observe, are there any differences between MERS and SARS and this outbreak?
Yes, so they're all different versions of coronaviruses. They're all from the same family. What we don't yet know with this outbreak is really how infectious this virus is, so how many people get the infection from other people, so person-to-person transmission, and how many people who get it get symptoms, and then how severe are those symptoms. So it's in the very early stages of finding all this stuff out. The information at the moment suggests that it's not very easy to transmit between people, and that's a good thing, because one of the reasons SARS was such a worry was because it was easily transmitted between people.
For now, we don't really know how is this disease transmitted. So in the meantime, what could we all do?
So here in New Zealand, it's probably not much of a worry for us. I mean, it's always good to practice good hand hygiene. So, you know, wash your hands frequently, but not too frequently. You know, if you come into contact with sick people, especially wash your hands. If you are unwell and you're sneezing and coughing, you know, do not cough and sneeze on your hands or over people. Cough into your or sneeze into your elbow. Things like if you're going to China, if you're going to Wuhan, then avoiding live animal markets is one thing. Or if you are going to those places, wash your hands afterwards. What else would it be? That's it, really. Just practice good hand hygiene and avoid live animal markets.
And given that the Lunar New Year holiday is next week, and obviously quite a lot of Chinese students might be coming back to New Zealand to start a new school year. Do you expect that we could see cases of that virus coming to New Zealand?
So it really depends on whether it's located in Wuhan or whether it is in other places, and that's completely unclear at the moment. Mainly because they actually don't know the source yet, so they think it was a particular live animal market, and that's been shut down now. But because they don't know the source, we don't know whether perhaps it was certain animals, and perhaps they're in other markets, so whether other people would have been exposed. I guess if you have been travelling overseas and you come back to New Zealand and you feel unwell, you know, then phone your doctor and say, you know, I'm not well, I've been overseas. Maybe phone rather than go in to see them, just so that, you know, you keep yourself isolated. As I say, it's very much an evolving thing. At the moment, we still don't know yet, you know, how many people who get sick will get really sick.
And following up on that question, because we don't know how many people who are sick might be coming here, do you think New Zealand should start any border measures like checking people's temperatures?
The evidence suggests that unless you've got sort of direct flights, which I don't believe we have, that you tend to end up misdiagnosing people. So, you know, there are lots of reasons why people might have a temperature and you end up catching, you know, stopping people for other reasons. So I think at the moment, while, you know, the numbers are still very low and it doesn't look like it's transmitted very well between people, that probably a watch and wait is absolutely fine.
That was me talking to Susie Wiles of Auckland University. And currently countries like the US and Thailand are now screening their border, while in Hong Kong, officials have announced yesterday health declaration forms will be used at the airport for flights from Wuhan, and monitoring will be expanded to cover everyone arriving from Hubei province, where Wuhan is located. But as you might have heard in the news, New Zealand has not done nothing yet regarding this situation. The Ministry of Health has declined a request for an interview, but in a statement it said they have been in frequent communication with the health sector to give advice since they are aware of the coronavirus in Wuhan, but the World Health Organization has not recommended any border measures to countries to date. The evidence is that thermal screening is generally ineffective at detecting influenza. A 2014 Canadian review concluded that the high number of false detections, along with the limited effectiveness, meant that the evidence did not support introducing them. And the ministry continues to monitor developments in this area, but has no current plans to recommend their use in New Zealand.
That was The Wire.
And that's all The Wire for today, the 21st of January. Thanks to my producer Louis Laws and Chris McGarrow. And also a big thanks to those who talked to us today. We've got Hugh Pavlich, Kira Davis from the PSA, and Professors Graham Gill, William Partlett, and Susie Wiles. Jin is here with you for the next 3 hours with the 124. We will be back next week after the long holiday. And speaking of that, enjoy the rest of the week. Enjoy a good long holiday. And see you next time. Au revoir.
That was a 95 BFM podcast. Support 95 BFM with a B card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup.